Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Bleary-eyed, teary-eyed, not so tanned and rested, post-debate DMZ show. How are you holding up this morning, Bill Scher?
I'm good. I thought that Stephen Harper had an okay night. Justin Trudeau, did
Does he
lay in
play
some
for the
punches, but
Oilers? Does he play for the Oilers or the
You're not following the Canadian leaders debate? I mean, that was the hot news last night.
I was
You got a three-way
watching the
race for him
other
between.
Canadian, Ted Cruz, and his debate.
Oh, okay. It's There was a lot going on, so you got to pick and choose what you watch. But I don't know if there was a real breakout moment. Yeah, it's a three-way race up there in Canada, and it's anybody's game.
That's a exciting country, and an exciting race that we're gonna spend the next hour talking about. I hope you guys are cool with lots of debate coverage because that's what you're gonna get.
Now, I did not watch the kids' table debate last night, but I was following Twitter and I noticed that you alone in the universe thought that Carly Fiorina did a terrible job. Everything else that I read says that she was the breakout star of the kids' table. She's the Gary Coleman of Republican debating.
I was really outside the mainstream, Bill. You're absolutely right about that. The general consensus is that she kicked butt, and but I'll tell you what it did. I do not think she came across as likable. I think she. I don't think she smiled once. Maybe at the very end, she seemed to me to be mean, and very serious. And I mean, I think there's a reason why some conservatives will like that. They want somebody who's angry and who's going to be tough. And she's, I mean, don't get me wrong, she had very concise, good answers. She continued what she's been doing this entire presidential race, which is to sort of impress with her knowledge and ability, the expertise, and command of the subjects, of the topics generally. But in terms, I always look for likability, and did not come across to me as likable at all. Came across as very cold, somewhat mean. But again,
But isn't her game to show that if you pick me as VP, I will be the female attack dog that will give no mercy to Hillary, and no one else, no male can be as mean to her as I can. I mean, isn't that what she's trying to communicate in this whole process?
yeah, I think that's probably true. I think that that's essentially her argument, and in that regard, she lived up to it. I do. This is gonna, again, but this is one of the many things I say that puts me in danger of being attacked for something, misogyny or something. But I do think there is a danger sometimes with trying to be the Iron Lady. That you want to overcompensate and show your toughness. And I don't, sometimes I think that's a mistake. And again, I'm in the minority here. The reviews were rave reviews for Carly. The consensus is that she dominated the kids' debate, the JV squad. But I do worry about that. And here's the other thing I would say is, even though all the evidence suggests that I'm out of touch and that I'm wrong, my experience has been that generally, eventually, my instincts come around to be right. And it does see, my guess is that conservatives who are looking at her, and maybe that's the audience that she needs right now anyway, it's a primary, that they may like anger more than the general public. But to me, there's a way to tell someone to go to hell, but make them look forward to the trip. Stick the knife in somebody, but do it with a little bit of a smile. I think she's got some. I think there's a potential likability problem there. And I, again, I'm the only one that really sees it. I have confidence that eventually, if she doesn't correct it, I will be proven right. But for today, I am that lone voice in the wilderness, and everybody else says she did amazing. So that's. I'm willing to accept the fact that
Well,
I'm willing to accept the fact that I'm way ahead of the curve on this one, and that I will be later proven right, if not in my lifetime, then after I'm dead.
Well, before you get accused of holding Carly to an unfair double standard, I think all the candidates, and I mean it may be a particular issue on the Republican side, but as a general matter, regardless of gender, they're all trying to find a sweet spot between having fire and passion and being upbeat and sunny and not tipping over into being angry. People talk about, well, Obama can't be angry because he's black. No, nobody can be angry to be president. But people don't want angry presidents. People want happy presidents.
Right, and there are, I
So
mean, and if
that's
you look
it.
at the great presidents or the great politicians, Reagan and Bill Clinton, both of them could feign anger. I mean, Bill Clinton could, Reagan's, I paid for this microphone, and Reagan could feign anger, and so could Bill Clinton. And when you attack his,
What?
when you attack his wife on
Well, I think
stage.
Clinton actually got too angry sometimes. Yeah, sometimes Clinton's anger was not controlled,
Okay, but
and
I
it
think
hurt
you
him
may
in
be
some
right. I think
occasions.
Reagan feigned it. I think Clinton's might be sincere, but they also could turn on the charm, and they also had a very fun, friendly, likable quality. And I think you gotta have both. You can't just do angry all the time. I don't think, I mean, I think it gets you, it'll get you some, you can make hay out of it in the primary for now, but eventually you gotta turn on the charm, I think, or be able to.
So, in the Matt Lewis grading, which doesn't factor in the Frank Luntz focus groups, doesn't counter what the Washington Insiders say, in the Matt Lewis Actors School of Candidate Training, in the big kids debate, who had the charm? Who showed that they could go the distance based on their policy positions aside, just on theatrical performance, who has the stuff?
Well, first, let me go back to the JV debate. I thought it was weird that the kids' debate didn't have anybody in the audience. And I'm telling you, you cannot overestimate the difference it makes when someone gets applause versus when they don't. There were things that, there were lines, for example, that Rick Perry said, or like jokes that completely fell flat, but might have gotten some applause and given him a boost of confidence and changed our perception. It's like having a laugh track. But
Well, why put them in the arena? Why not just have them in a small round table setting and not have them be in this giant cavern that they weren't going to do any effort to fill the room
I
with?
mean, there must, and they could have filled, there were some people saying that they couldn't fill the room. It was too early. That's bull. They could have
Well,
easily filled the room.
they don't hold it in the room. Put it
Well,
somewhere
no, but there were
else.
people, I saw pictures of people. Of people in Cleveland at other locations in huge rooms watching it on TV, having the watch parties. I mean, the idea that, well, it was 5 o'clock, people in Ohio are working. Maybe it was 4 o'clock out there. I don't know what the time zones are. I try to avoid leaving the coast. You know that, Bill. But
5 o'clock is after the Friendly's early bird. The
look.
average Fox News watcher has nothing else to do. They could be there at 5 o'clock if they wanted to.
Well, anyway, I agree. I agree. And it makes a big difference. There must have been some logistical reasons why they wanted to do what they did in terms of the cameras and all that. But it was weird. But look, in terms of, I'll just give you my take on the varsity debate in general. First, I think it was entertaining as hell. It was a great, I think it showed that the 2016 field is dramatically improved and superior over the last field. I think the decision to ask Donald Trump, or to ask the question, that first question, raise your hand if you won't vow to support the Republican candidate and not run a third party ticket, was a stroke of brilliance. I think it opened, it was just an, it was electric. I think that I think the veil is starting to slip for Trump. I think he was starting to become exposed for who he really is, which is not a conservative. Who he cannot talk specific. I think Chris Wallace proved the point that he cannot say anything that's specific or detailed. And I think others demonstrated that he's not a conservative. He supports single payer. And then I
You're
think,
not listening, Matt.
I
You're not
know.
listening to what he said.
I know. Well, he it was somewhat nuanced, but and then I think it comes down to like sort of, there's not one winner in a multi-candidate debate, but I thought Jeb, I hear I'm sort of an outlier here too. I thought Jeb did really well. I thought Rubio did really well, except that Megyn Kelly question about abortion exceptions, I think really may do long-term damage to him if he's the nominee, or pose at least long-term problems.
You know, Democrats are saying that. I see a lot of Democrats saying because he, you know, here's Rubio. His name is on a bill that has those exceptions
that
they sponsored not too long ago, and he then sounds in the debate like he's not. He said, "Well, I've never advocated for that."
Yeah. I agree with him on that. I mean, just because he supported a bill that has exceptions, he might just see that as an incremental step toward banning all abortion.
Right, and I thought that this was a classic two-step where he can shade his position one way for the primary without putting the actual words in his mouth. You know, he doesn't say specifically, "I am for outlawing all abortions, no exceptions." He doesn't say that. Megyn Kelly says that.
Right.
And he says, "I've never advocated for that." So you can't take the soundbite and plop into an ad easily. And so he can very easily go into the general saying, you know, "Well, what I'm going to advocate for, or my position is, or what I'm comfortable with." You know, he can characterize it all sorts of ways to indicate, "I'm not actually going to do that."
No.
You said with Larry Hogan. Larry Hogan in Maryland was like, "Well, I'm not going to do anything about social issues. Who cares what my actual position is?" There's all sorts of ways you can.
Are you saying he could have handled it that way, or that he did handle it that way?
I think he did handle that. Oh, I disagree. I think he.
I think he came out. I think it's very clear now that he doesn't support any exceptions, and I think that's. Look, Megyn Kelly asked the kind of question that George Stephanopoulos or Chris Matthews could have asked. And I think now Rubio, maybe I got to go back and watch the tape, but my impression certainly is that Rubio is now on the record as having no exceptions on abortion. And that's just not, it's entirely, philosophically, it's entirely coherent, if you know. But politically speaking, we went from talking about Planned Parenthood, harvesting organs of babies, to talking about if a woman's raped, she can't have an abortion. Like, it's just the terrain is not where you want to be. Bill, we've talked about this a million times.
Oh, I think if he stayed firmly in that position in the general, that would be political suicide. I just think he will have the ability to pivot off of that and communicate something different in the general. I don't think he is pinned down for good based on that answer.
Well, I hope you're right, Bill. But I think he is now on the record, and I think that this.
Well, play people have been on the record and have been.
Well, look, off of the odds are that us talking now may become part of a Hillary Clinton commercial. Even conservative Matt Lewis says, "If you do that, Hillary, show you know, make me look good." I'm glad I shaved for you this morning. Anyway,
well, look, you know, take Cory Gardner in Colorado. I mean, the guy is on the record for being for a personhood amendment in federal legislation, and he runs swearing up and down, "I'm not for personhood." And the Democrats say, "No, you are. You're sponsoring this bill, blah, blah, blah." And he's like, "What are you talking about? I'm not for that. I got a nice smile on my face. It's all good."
I think you show that. I mean, I think you take, if you can legally, and I think you can, you just take the footage of Megyn Kelly asking Rubio that question and show it. And then
you got to take the whole exchange. I mean, when Mitt Romney said self-deportation, that's one word, you know, it's just one word that you stick in the video, and it says it all.
All right.
With this exchange, you got to do the whole exchange. It soaks up the whole ad, and so it becomes much more cumbersome to hit him with it.
Well, I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree. I think that Megyn Kelly potentially did long-term damage to Rubio. And that this was the kind of question that George Stephanopoulos or Chris Matthews might have asked, which is precisely why the RNC and Ryan Priebus tried to change the. You know, this was a wedge question that puts Rubio in basically a lose-lose proposition. I mean, he either angers the base by endorsing these exceptions, or he boxes himself in the general. It's much better to just be vague about it and to fight. Essentially you want the message without saying it. You want the message to be this: look, I would love to ban all abortions because I believe that life begins at conception. However, pragmatically, I need to get elected first. And if we can, you know, stop the, you know, let's go after the if a baby's 20 weeks old, that's infanticide. Let's go there first. Let's ban that, and then we'll see where we get. She sort of deprived him now of that that space.
Now, a lot of folks are saying that Rubio had a great debate. Ruby had a great debate. John Kasich had a great debate. And that Jeb was flat and Walker was diminished. Yeah, that's, I feel that's sort of like the pundit take that I'm hearing. And then you see the Frank Luntz focus group after that ran on Fox after the debate. And everyone dumped on Trump, as a lot of pundits are also. But then they say, well, who did you like? And they all go, Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, which, you know, those guys are pretty much nowhere.
I thought Cruz had a horrible debate. I think he just got, there was like an hour where I didn't even remember that Cruz was in the debate. They just completely overshot.
I think he had very little actual speaking time relative to the other candidates, but he had that strong close. There's certain folks that had a really good close because they got to just say the spiel that they've been honing on the stump forever, not have to actually answer a question. So
he did finish strong, and it's possible that he benefits by virtue of Trump flaming out too.
Well, he might benefit from people who are sitting in a Frank Luntz focus group room watching the debate end to end. That's not necessarily what's going to loop on TVs over the course of the next few days and stick in people's minds.
Well, I'm always skeptical.
Sort of effect.
I'm always skeptical of the Frank Luntz focus group in general.
I hear you completely,
but I'm out of touch. I agree that Rubio did very well, with the huge exception that we just talked about, which doesn't hurt him now, but could haunt him if he's the nominee. So I think Rubio had a great night in the short term, and probably won. I thought Jeb Bush did great. I thought he came across as likable, a happy warrior, and I thought he did a really good job of taking issues like Common Core and immigration reform, which should have and could have hurt him with the base, and turning them around and being very hawkish and having a great explainer to conservatives as to why these issues are actually conservative issues. I thought Jeb did incredibly well. I honestly can't imagine how he could have done better, and yet I think I'm out of step with the public there.
Well, I'm sort of between that pundit conventional wisdom and you. I don't think he had a terrible debate. I think he could have been better I think the basic, you know, structure of the answers was fine. The tone was fine. I mean, it is that basic upbeat happy warrior that I think a nominee has to have. It was a little halting, a little unsteady. You know, it wasn't as sharp as I think Rubio sort of has it down. Like Rubio's gone to candidate school and did the extra credit work, and now it all kind of comes together in a nice package. Scott Walker went to candidate school and did the bare minimum. Like he regurgitates within the textbook, but there's no passion, emotion to it outside of talking about unions when it's his own comfort zone. When he goes outside his comfort zone, it's all very rote. And Kasich is fully himself. And he had the luck of being in his hometown crowd, having a nice little cheering section behind him.
I thought Jeb and Kasich got a lot of applause. And I mean, Kasich, obviously, it's a home game for him. I thought Jeb got a lot of applause, too.
I think he did fine. And I think for Jeb, and I wrote this back when I said it's going to be Hillary versus Jeb, Jeb doesn't have to do as well as everybody else.
Yeah.
A mediocre Jeb is sufficient if everybody else is stuck in the scrum and can't break out. I think Rubio did very well in many respects, but did he have a breakout moment? Is he gonna just rocket 10 points in the polls because of it? No, he did a pretty good job, but that's not enough to have that moment. Like Obama in 2007, July 2007, had a breakout moment when he was asked, would you negotiate with Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, personally, directly with the other side's leaders in your first year? And he unflinchingly said, absolutely. We have to get past the notion that there's something wrong with talking to the people. And Hillary thought he had him in a box, was making him sound naive, and Obama owned it. That was a real kind of game changer moment that helped them separate from the pack. And right. I didn't see anything like that. There's no breakout idea that Ruby or others had. But so I think Ruby did a better job than Bush as far as the theatrics are concerned. But Jeb has 10 times the money. So
yeah. Well, I thought Jeb did what he needed to do. Jeb, I mean, he passed the threshold. He didn't fall off the stage, and he did well. By the way, speaking of Obama, Mark Murray over at NBC News tweets some perspective. Who was the winner of the first Dem debate in 2007? John Edwards. Who didn't look so hot? Barack Obama. So,
I mean, you go back to Obama's earlier appearances. You know, he was raw. He was not fully seasoned. And it took, you know, the great ones get better as they go along and they learn from their mistakes. And Obama did. So you can't necessarily look at the first debate and say everyone sort of, you know, etched in stone. But we have seen them on the trail for, those early Dem debates were earlier. You know, they started pretty much quicker in the cycle. We've had now a good 6 months of campaigning before this first debate. So you've seen who's grown and who hasn't. You know, I think Walker really has not grown. You know, he can recite certain foreign leaders' names now, but he still can't be fluid on issues outside of union busting.
Yeah.
You see Jeb, you know, he's had his weak spots, but as you pointed out, you know, he's really figured out that Common Core answer. You know, he's worked on that. He's turned the issue around so it mitigates the damage owning that position has had for him. So you see that kind of growth.
And immigration, too. I think he took it was a compassionate answer, but also an answer that conservatives should have liked a lot of what he was talking about. Building a wall, getting rid of sanctuary cities. I mean, he was able to pivot and hit, like, some conservative sweet spots without betraying his stated position. I think it's very shrewd what Jeb did.
Walker busted on the flip flop again. You know, Jeb is not flip flopped. You know, he's back before he was for citizenship. Now he's sort of scaled it back to the legal status. But putting that aside, you know, he's still putting it out there on legal status, while showering it with other conservative goodies. Where Scott Walker much more inelegantly said, "Oh yeah, I just changed my mind because I heard the people, and now amnesty's awful." Yeah, that's not as elegant, and that hurts him more.
We did mention this, Bill, but I think we should spend a little more time, obviously, on Donald Trump, because I felt like, look, nobody knows what's going to happen with Trump. He could have a horrible performance and go up in the polls. So he's not a normal politician, and it's entirely possible that his supporters are locked in. He could, you know, do anything. And they would remain loyal to him. But one does get the sense that the continual erosion or the lifting of the veil, I mean, that we're slowly, and I've always argued, the key to Trump is you can't keep him out of the debates, give him enough rope to hang himself, let him reveal himself to be the demagogue that he actually is. And I think last night, you know, voters were now, if you're a Republican voter watching, you know, number one, he will not support the Republic. He will not vow to support the Republican nominee. He will not vow not to run a third party campaign. You learned that he likes to, you know, he gave Hillary Clinton money because he wanted her to come to his wedding. Why would any Republican or conservative want Hillary Clinton to come to their wedding? And it's also just seems really skeevy to, like, give somebody money so they'll come to your wedding. So it's weird. And then I think it's very obvious that he could not talk about specifics, that he speaks just in generalities. It's all about trust me, I'm smart, I'm successful, I'm a winner, trust me.
That kind of applies to a lot of them, though. I didn't hear a whole lot of policy specifics from anybody last night.
Well, I don't know. I thought that I will say this. I thought the best exchange was really between Rand Paul and Chris Christie over NSA, data collection, metadata collection. And that was a substantive debate. And I thought that was probably overshadowed, but a very really good exchange. I don't know if you saw that or not, Bill, but
Well, I saw it. It's
really good.
overshadowed by the fact that both of them were pulling about 4%. Nobody cares. I mean, it's an interesting subject, and they had a lot of fire about it. But neither one of them are remotely competitive. And for for Christie, Christie needs to show that he can, overcome Trump and Jeb, and show that he is the best vis-a-vis Hillary. Beating up on Rand over. Civil liberties. Rand's not holding the Hillary Clinton position or the Barack Obama position. He's out there in his own space. He's holding the Edward Snowden position. So showing you can wail on him over that doesn't get you where he needs to go. And Rand has a position that the bulk of the Republican Party doesn't agree with, so it doesn't get him anywhere. So I just that's so I think it's going to remain overshadowed because it's just not relevant to how you get into the driver's seat in the Republican primary.
yeah, I mean we'll see. It's the first debate. We'll see if Rand or Christie goes anywhere. But I thought it was a great exchange, and I thought it was a substantive exchange. But back to the main point, I think that Trump continues to be revealed to be who he really is, and I think that last night is one more step along the way of Trump's coming.
Well, it's a test of to what extent are the Trump fanboys and fangirls just, all in on Trump, where nothing matters. You love Trump and you love his style and you think he's refreshing, he's going to kick ass and take names, and you just don't care what he says and how he says it anymore. I suspect, the most recent polls that we saw, he was really starting to pull away again. He was in the mid-20s. And Jeb was in like the low tens, and so it was a solid double-digit lead Trump was having. I would guess, and guessing often gets us very wrong, but perhaps like a portion of that are people who are soft Trump, and he loses some ground over getting beat around this debate. But there's going to be some hard Trump that is immovable, and we don't know how big that is yet. I would guess it's still going to be around. 15 or so. And 15 at this stage of the race still keeps you in first place, or at least, tied for first place.
Yeah, but I think I agree. I agree. But I think that the real danger is that Trump was peeling off sort of normal conservatives. And I think at some point that it becomes supporting him becomes untenable. If you're a regular sort of conservative Republican guy, you didn't know that. Like, I can't imagine, like, my dad sitting on a couch watching this debate. And look, I could imagine my dad, who's been dead 11 years. I mean, I could imagine my dad sort of not paying attention to politics a few weeks ago and kind of liking some of what Donald Trump said. And oh, there's a guy who's telling it like it is. But I can't imagine my dad watching the debate and hearing Trump talk about how he gave Hillary Clinton money so she'd come to his wedding, and liking that. So I do feel like there were things that Trump is saying that and that people are starting to realize who he really is.
Well, you may find, as your Democrats found in 2008, you might not know your party as well as you think you do. I was doing some early punditry on the radio back then, and after Obama won Iowa, I said, "Well, there's going to be a bandwagon effect now, and he's just going to coast because between Hillary and Edwards and Obama, their policy positions are basically the same." There's no deep divide in the party, so whoever gets the first head of steam is just going to run away with it. And that might have made some logical sense on paper. I mean, it's still true that there wasn't a lot of ideological difference between them, but as we learned, there's still a pretty deep divide materialized for a time. Now, I was correct in the long run that it wasn't a, since it wasn't an ideological split, it was easy to heal at the end of the day. But there were lots of very unpleasant feelings about race and gender that got aired out, and a whole debate about what makes most pragmatic sense as far as being having an idealistic tone or having a more of a hard and cautionary tone, all that kind of stuff. And we learned a lot about ourselves over the course of those few months. So you might start finding Republicans saying, well, you know, single payer does work in Canada. Don't blame Trump for that. You know, he was just looking at Canada and saying, look, it works okay there. That's not a crazy thing to say.
Yeah, right. But he also said that, I mean, he also implied that it would have worked here 15 years ago, right? I don't think
Right.
I'm misrepresenting him.
In that age, as Trump,
In that age, as if it was
2000 made
500
total
years ago.
sense.
No, it
The
was.
world has totally transformed since then.
I mean, that was how I heard it, that he was saying that 15 or 20 years ago, single payer would have worked great in America, but now things are radically different.
Right.
Am I misrepresenting that, Bill?
No, that's exactly what he
Okay.
said.
So if you're a conservative, a real hardcore Tea Party conservative who is stupid enough to support Donald Trump, then you deserve a country with a president, Donald Trump. That's my take. And maybe we should.
Now you're hating on the people. You're like a liberal elitist. You know, the people are too stupid. They can't understand the brilliance of true
No, I
conservatism. They
believe,
deserve Trump.
no, because I believe that I have faith that the American public and the conservatives are seeing Donald Trump for who he is. And that's why we have these, that's why we play the game, Bill. That's why we lift all these weights. That's why we have these debates, so that Trump will show himself. I am confident that the vast majority of my people out there, the conservatives, the God-fearing, salt of the earth people who work hard and make this country work, that they're going to see Donald Trump for who he is. I'm an optimist like that.
Now, I want to go back to a point I was making earlier. We both had little blurbs in Politico today with our takes.
Yeah.
There was a round of about 20 pundit takes. And mine was that I decided not to get into the who won, who lost business because pundits always say X and then the polls always say Y. So why get burned? But how did the party look as a whole? Because I think it's fair to say that the party looked badly as a whole throughout the 2012 process. They got pulled far to the right, you know, encapsulated by Mitt Romney having to say for self-deportation, and that hurt the party brand in the general and beyond, which is why the RNC took over the debates to say we're not going to have all these debates that make us look bad. We're going to narrow it down and control the moderators, yada yada yada. So did the party look like a fresher, newer, more mainstream party? And I said, well, on one hand, sort of, Trump didn't own the debate. He didn't look like he was the face of the party because he was so embattled. And Bush and Rubio and Kasich had more sunny, upbeat rhetoric, so they didn't all look like a bunch of haters. But it was really bereft on breakout ideas. And I still think that coming out of George W. Bush's presidency, people want to say, what are you going to do that's different than what failed before? And not a lot of intellectual spade work's been done on that, coming up to the debate, nor did anyone try to decide to unveil anything fresh at the debate. So I still think if you're looking at the party as a whole, you're asking yourself, what is this party going to do? That would really make the besides just giving me the warmed over rhetoric that's been used in the past. That's what I feel like is still missing there.
Well, they're very well, they tried to limit the number of debates, and they're very well may come a point of diminishing returns. I think that last night was a net plus. I think that you come that I think it was fun, and it was not a clown car. And I think that, generally speaking, last night made the Republicans look good. I think that this field is strong. Clearly, this is not Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, and Santorum and Newt. I mean, this is a strong field, and I think they generally look good. Now, again, who knows how that'll age, and if there may come a point of diminishing returns. But for now, I'm not worried about that. Right now, I think that overall, very well.
Now, the Democrats debates are going to start in October. They revealed their schedule. It's going to be once a month, starting in October. Now, Rubio had a quip that, you know, God has blessed them with, you know, 17 wonderful candidates and they can't find one good one on the Democratic side. But, you know, even with the smaller field that they have, you know, they're a debate is emerging over, okay, how do we reduce economic inequality? You know, do we break up the banks or we have different Wall Street regulation? Do we have what tax changes do we have to make? They're talking about different climate proposals right now. Hillary's going to unveil a student loan proposal on Monday. That debate's been joined on the Democratic side. I don't see anything remotely parallel on the policy tip happening on the Republican side. I mean, you can say, well, you know, Rand has a flat tax and Huckabee has a fair tax, but these are sort of off-the-shelf ideas that Republicans have tried in past debates that don't really get out of the idea stage. And it's not really gelling into, okay, here are some ideas that we're bandying about that once we have this debate, will get put into action if one of us wins. You know, that happened in 2008 with healthcare in particular. Do you think they need to do that, or is that just me being a liberal egghead? Nobody really cares.
No, I think it's important, and I think that by the way, to put it in context, I think the Republican debate started in May 4 years ago, and here we are in August, and then the Democrats will start in December. I think that
October.
I'm sorry, in October. Thanks for I'm a little sleep deprived today. Not, you know, normally 99.9% correct, documentably correct on this show, but today slipping up. Not peak Lewis. No, I think that it's going to be very interesting when the debates start, and I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see. You know, we'll flip the tables with the clown car thing. I mean, does this make Hillary stronger, or does it push her farther to the left, going up against especially Bernie Sanders right now? And trying to co-opt that message. And I think it's going to be very interesting.
I mean, I don't see any evidence so far that Bernie is forcing Hillary to take a position that she would not have otherwise have taken. You know, the rhetoric might be massaged a little bit differently.
No debates
but
yet,
even
though.
There,
no debates yet, though.
We'll see the debates.
Yeah.
But she's laying out her policy positions now. She's
yeah.
drawing her lines.
Right, but
you
so
know,
look what
she.
happened to Rubio last night. With a friendly question from, you know, friendly in quotes, allegedly friendly. Bill, you and I have been arguing, I think, for years probably that the Fox News poses a much more serious threat to Republicans than they realize.
Well,
because,
I wrote a whole piece for Politico about that. I tried to warn them.
Yeah.
I said the Fox News softball is going to be very dangerous.
I mean, they're going to ask
I
hard
tweeted several times
questions.
this week.
They were going to try to prove that they're not, that they were trying to prove that they are fair and balanced. So anyway, so it could happen to Hillary. It may not be just because Bernie's on stage with her, but it could be a question from. And by the way, I think MSNBC does not have a debate with the Dems. Is that right? It's NBC does.
Well, NBC does. I think that's sort of a little overblown. I mean, I bet MSNBC will simulcast it. You know, they there's only, you know, I think four locked in because you don't know how long the primary is going to go. So they have October, November, December, January. I think those were firmly set. And they went to ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN. So you know, NBC gets it,
right?
And it's like that's wholly separate from MSNBC. So I don't see that as a big
right. So,
snub.
But just to put it, just to
the big boys,
just to use the like analogy. I mean, it's entirely possible that Chuck Todd asks a question to Hillary that gets her out over her skis on the left on something.
You know, if there is a candidate that is going to be prepared for all possible questions and has thought through all the landmines that are out there for her, it's going to be Hillary. I mean, I don't think she's going to be, you know, caught off guard and blurt out something that she wasn't intending to say under pressure.
Yeah, she'll just be boring. And that's
yeah,
kind
right.
of what she needs to
exactly.
be.
Exactly. You know, we already she's been pressed on Glass-Steagall, for example, and she had a very complicated answer that didn't quite take a firm position, but made pretty clear she wasn't going to go whole hog on Glass-Steagall restoration. You know, I mean, they know all the stuff that's out there waiting to trip them up, and they know what they don't want to get pinned down on. They want to maximize
yeah.
her flexibility. So,
well, but
I think
not to like, I don't want to beat a dead horse here and just sort of play out every scenario, but it is possible. The way that Chris Matthews was able to, I did it again, the way that Chris Wallace was able,
right.
was the way that Chris Wallace was able to demonstrate that that Donald Trump cannot deal in specifics or cite actual examples. It would be possible for Chuck Todd to demonstrate that Hillary Clinton is inauthentic and unwilling to take a stand.
Oh, that's
and unwilling to take
that's
a stand.
That's a risk.
And
that's a real
yeah.
risk. I mean, I imagine she'll get really pressed on, you know, she'll get pressed on trade and she'll get pressed on, you know, past positions on gay marriage, for example. You know, she's not going to get soft treatment in the debates. And she might have a bad moment like she had in 2007 where she got tied up on immigration and driver's licenses that made people suddenly get very nervous that she was overly calculating and was going to get be too vulnerable in a general. So, you know, the debates pose a threat to her. But I don't think the problem for her is inadvertently taking a position too far to the left for the general. I think that issue she is very unlikely to get caught trapped in.
Good point. All right, Bill, I'm fading here, but let's move off the debates.
Well, speaking of Hillary, I have a piece that should be up at Politico. Perhaps by the time this video is uploaded, raising the question: how does she deal with the Joe Biden buzz, the Biden boom, and the notion that Biden is thinking about it at all? Is that Hillary's numbers have sagged in recent months because she's been weighed down by questions about her honesty and trustworthiness. And the thing about being a Clinton is you've seen everything before. There's no crisis or circumstance that you're not familiar with.
It's baked in the cake. Baked in the cake.
Right. So, you know, in 1992, you know, Bill Clinton was worrying about some towering Democrat jumping in the race late named Mario Cuomo. His numbers got weighed down in early 1992 over questions over his honesty and trustworthiness after Jennifer Flowers and the draft dodging charges. Now, in the case of Bill, those two issues were separate because the Cuomo tease ran through December of 91. So they had their first debate in December that year. Clinton didn't even announce till the fall. You know, that whole time that was pushed forward because, you know, George H.W. Bush, his poll numbers were so strong in early 91, people waited on people on Al Gore and Bill Bradley. Were they going to jump in? They didn't. And so the lesser names waited until later to make their announcements. And then there was this holding pattern. What's Cuomo going to do? And nothing Bill Clinton could have done about that, really. He wasn't a big figure in his own right yet. He couldn't Bigfoot Cuomo out. He just had to sit and wait and see what Cuomo was going to do. But once Cuomo did beg off, Clinton had this quick rise as sort of the most complete package of who was left, and then got blindsided by Jennifer Flowers and the draft dodging stuff.
By the way, let me just jump in real quick, Bill, because earlier we were talking about how you sort of botched a prediction in 08 about Obama.
Impossible.
And this is a real peril for prognosticators. We all get it wrong. But there's some poor bastard in that there's a documentary, The War Room, about the Clinton 92 campaign. And right around the time the Jennifer Flowers thing came up, there's some poor bastard, some pundit that they show a video of saying, I think Bill Clinton will be out of the race by the end of the week. The pressure's just going to be too immense. He's going to have. I don't know who that poor bastard was, but you never want to have.
Still, the job makes more money than either one of us.
You don't want to have like your worst political, you know, pundit moment captured in a documentary and shown like ad nauseum over and over. Like the clip of there could be the clip of Bill Scherer saying, "Yeah, Obama is just going to now coast."
The audio is out there. If any historian wants to dig it up.
Well, it would have been really bad if Hillary for you had Hillary won the nomination, but it was not quite as bad as this as this poor chap. on this, I don't know who the guy is in the documentary, but someone will tell us maybe.
But you know, Clinton got through the early stage of those pressures by generally denying and saying that's none of people's business and let's talk about the issues. And so there was already an early sign that this notion of being authentic and trustworthy, you know, wasn't the most important thing in the world. You know, Ron Fournier has said, you know, authenticity is the coin of the realm of modern politics, so Hillary has to deal with this or she's in deep trouble. So that was an early indication that maybe that wasn't the case, that you could sort of blow past it.
No, I know that you are not a Francophile and you hate the French, but I believe it's pronounced Fournier. And,
oh, I'm sorry.
And I know this because Ron and I, we just went to see the Orioles together, Bill.
I know you. I saw you at the ballpark on Twitter. So I defer to your pronunciation wisdom.
Fournier.
If
you please.
But after Clinton, you know, effectively wrapped up the nomination, the team was doing a lot of focus grouping, and they were getting a lot of pushback from swing voters that Clinton wasn't honest and he wasn't trustworthy, and their sense was it wasn't about the specifics of the scandal so much as that it made him look like a typical politician, not an agent of change. So their wisdom was, we don't take this head on. We got to fill the space with something different that speaks to his character. And that became mainly his biography, The Man from Hope, raised by a widowed mom who stood up to his abusive drunken stepfather, worked his way through college. When his half brother was busted for drugs, locked him up, didn't pull any strings for him. You know, all those sorts of things that at that time people didn't know about because he was so new to the stage. And the focus grouping showed that really mitigated, if not turned, people's perceptions all the way around. Now, there's other things that they did as far as issues were concerned as well, but that was pretty key to changing the equation. And it didn't change it completely. You know, there still were a lot of people today call him Slick Willie. It's not like everyone looks at him as a paragon of honesty, you know, 20 years later. But it never became the dominant issue of the general election, no matter how hard George H.W. Bush tried to make it so. So what's happening today with Hillary, you know, she's been dogged by the email controversy, you know, before she announced. That came out in March. She announced in April. She announced her first televised ads this past week, which some say, well, she's so panicked about Joe Biden, she's rushing these ads to the screen. Now, maybe that's true to a degree, yeah. But these ads were in the can. These are polished ads. They didn't do them overnight. And they have the same messaging that they had, that an online video came up in May about, and they all have to do with Hillary's mom.
Yeah.
How her mom had a hard luck childhood and fought her way through to put a life together for herself. And that infused Hillary with her sense of values and her sense of grit and work ethic and the need to do something for the middle-class families of today. It's right out of that Bill Clinton 1992 Man from Hope playbook. And now we can debate whether it's going to work as well for Hillary or not, but clearly that is the intention, if not just to keep Biden out of the race, but to stabilize her numbers and not let the Republicans make her personal character the issue going into the general election.
Well, I think you're right about the intent, the motive, and what they're trying to do. I would say I think that there's an important distinction to be made between Bill Clinton's honesty and Hillary's lack of authenticity. And I believe that you're right. Bill Clinton's sort of slipperiness is baked into the cake, and his credibility never came from the fact that he was going to be the puritanical guy. It was that he's sort of like you, like us. I'm you. I think in our modern era, it's less important to be quote unquote honest than it is to be authentic. And that may seem like I'm splitting hairs, but I think that Bill Clinton always seemed authentic. He always seemed real. And so he sort of owned his faults, you know. Yeah, of course, hell, I'm not perfect. You know, we've all, you know. But I think Hillary is a phony. And I think that if there's one impardonable sin, you know, we used to care about things like virtue. I think now we care, you know, now we fetishize authenticity. And so I think that the Hillary's problem is that she's running up against a value that we actually hold in high regard still. It's maybe the last remaining thing that Americans care about as a value. I mean, tolerance would be the other one, right? Tolerance and authenticity have replaced, I don't know, chastity and virtue, let's say.
Well, but there's still competence, there's still ideology, there's still policy positions, there's still sense of values. There's a reason why, no matter what trial humor or what poll you're looking at, Hillary beats Trump by 20 points, right? It's not because she's more authentic than Donald Trump. Donald Trump's pretty authentic, but he fails at every other score. So now that might not be as easy
Well, I don't think
a
Trump's going to be the nominee. But anyway, look, I'm just saying I think you're right about what the Clintons are trying to do, and maybe it'll work, but I think that Hillary, that her challenges are different than Bill's challenges. And
Yeah, I mean,
she is much less like, I don't know what I need to like watch this Seinfeld episode because I keep like misquoting it, but there's a part where like somebody wants, I think Jerry wants to learn how to pass a lie detector test. And he asks Costanza how to do it. And Costanza says, like, that's like going to Pavarotti and saying, like, teach me how to sing like you. Like, using Bill Clinton as a model is inherently flawed because nobody is as good of a politician as Bill Clinton. And
Well, I mean,
so,
the singular lesson out of that episode is it's not a lie if you believe it. That
yes,
is,
yes.
that's the life lesson.
Is that a lie if you believe it?
There are definitely differences in their predicaments. Clinton was new and was being defined early badly, and coming out of the primary was so bruised he was running third behind Clinton and behind Bush and Perot. But he also had a lot of upside because he was so new and people didn't know a lot about him, and so he could fill the gaps in relatively easy. And Bush became weakened over the economy, so he had an easy foil there. Hillary's situation is different. She's been in the spotlight for over 20 years, so she's fairly well known. Although even things like her mom, you probably didn't know, so there's always something new you can add to the situation, but she's not in third place. She's in first place. She's in first place in the primary. She's still in first place in the general in most polls. So she doesn't have as much padding to have to get. She only has to. She adds on a few points. She's pretty good. So in some ways she has a harder challenge. In some ways she doesn't have to do as much to put herself in the catbird seat. Again, you and I can't predict today how well that strategy is going to work for her. But I don't think it is implausible to say that's going to work because she doesn't have that far to go, the way things stand today.
Indeed. All right. Gots to roll, but pre-order Too Dumb to Fail at Amazon and check out Bill's latest piece that we were just talking about. It's in what is that Politico magazine, Bill?
So I'll come on Politico soon. Also, I had a piece in Real Clear Politics on Monday, which got lots of people mad, why if Trump ran third party, he would not hurt the Republican Party. If you haven't seen that yet, feel free to read that and email me. Tell me why I'm ridiculous.
All right, check it out, guys. And Bill, we'll see you and all of you back here next week in the DMZ. Have a good one.
Take care.
Yep.